little different message today than normal, but I think it'll be certainly of value. You know, one of the true blessings of God's way of life is the education, understanding, and the personal application of God's model of family that he teaches. All of us, no matter if we're married or not, are introduced to familial relationships the way God has intended they be structured. These fundamental principles that govern our human family structure are meant to be practiced, honed, if you will, by us today, and they're meant to be put into practice in our lives so that in the future we can use them to empower the spiritual family's growth. Many in the millennium and billions upon billions in the second resurrection will need to learn God's way of family structure and how it operates. Many of us in this room have been married for a number of years. All of us who I think own vehicles understand that we want them to run as intended, and in order to get them to run as intended for the long term, we need to give some periodic maintenance to keep everything running correctly. I don't, you know, how many times you've been driving your car down the road. I have a fairly new car, and it's developed a little bit of a squeak that just drives me absolutely nuts. You buy a new car, you don't think a squeak should pop its ugly head up until 7 or 8 years down the road, you know. But it's like that for us. We're used to driving our own vehicles, and every once in a while a new sound will kind of rear its head, and your mind just zeroes in on that sound. And before long, that sound may turn to worry or concern, and before long you're before a mechanic or someone you know that's good at dealing with mechanics of cars, and you try to figure out what that issue is before it strands you alongside the road, right? And so in that same fashion, in the spirit of a tune-up, I'd like to talk about marriage today. And today I thought I would just simply walk through some of the steps I take when I'm counseling a couple for marriage. I want to do this in hopes that it just gives us a personal cause, maybe, to fine-tune our own marriage. And for those that aren't married, there are some good physical and spiritual analogies to be had in the message today as well. So you're not off the hook. You can't go to sleep. One of the tried and true workbooks that have been available to ministry, whether in this church or in other churches, has been Before You Say I Do. And it's been revamped here a few years. I know I've seen some older copies of it with some pictures on there of bell-bottom jeans and big feathered hair and those kinds of things. The book's been around a while, but it has been kind of revamped a little bit. It's written by Norman Wright. It's been, again, updated to be a little more modern in its language, but its format has been really used extensively by the ministry through the years. One of the questions that couples that are counseling for marriage will be asked right from the get-go in chapter one is, do you believe marriage is a contract? Why or why not? Do you believe marriage is a contract? Why or why not? Now, it's interesting to hear people's response. We ask these questions because we want to be certain that the couples that are going into this that their mind is framed by the right context, by the right principles. No one should ever enter a personal binding agreement without completely understanding what they're agreeing to, of course. The other reason we go over this material early, because when the couple's standing up in front of the family and friends, their hands are clammy and shaking, and their minds are probably pretty clouded with a bazillion different things going on in their mind. The last thing they listen to is what the minister's saying. And so the minister, pastors, counselors, they try to go through these things ahead of time so that they can affirm what they're agreeing to, because when they actually ask the questions, when they're up in front of everybody, you get the blank stare and the clammy hand. So it's important that we walk them through a lot of these things ahead of time. I had the honor of being able to attend the Boyd's wedding, and really appreciated that. I thought the people that helped out at the wedding were nothing short of heroic, considering the heat, but I didn't see a lot of frowns. Everybody was smiling, having a wonderful time, and it's no small feat to pull off a wedding in general, but to do it under those kind of heat conditions was just wonderful to see all hands on deck in that regard. I will say I was sitting there watching the ceremony, and I pick on Sonia and Noah a little bit. I was sitting there watching the ceremony and listening to Frank Dunkel, who was performing the wedding, and listening to his questions and seeing both of their faces. And as I suspected I would see, was a lot of wandering eyes and a lot of thoughts going on in the head, and I bet very little of really drinking in what Frank was saying. So this premarital counseling is important. We know those are highly emotional times. I had to get a little bit of a giggle just watching it, but I understand it. I was there in your spot many years ago. So when we ask a couple at the beginning of their counseling, do you believe the marriage is a contract? Why or why not? I'm very curious as to the answers that I get. As part of the counseling, again, we go over them ahead of time in detail. And what will be said by the, again, by the minister in the ceremony, kind of goes over the head. So we want to cover these things ahead of time. So we say in the actual ceremony, we will say something to the effect of this: do you covenant with God in the presence of these witnesses to take, and then the names? You know, the wording's important because the two most powerful contracts we will make in our entire lives will be, first of all, baptism for eternity, and then secondly, marriage for life. All the other contracts are between you and someone else. This contract is really not between two of you. There's a reasonable amount of people who understand it is a contract. I think if you stopped anybody along the sidewalk and talked to them about this, they would understand that it involves a contract, but they believe it is between the bride and the groom. And it isn't. It's not, do you, Billy, contract with Susie? Do you, Susie, contract with Billy? It's, do you both contract or enter this covenant with God in the presence of these witnesses? So however many are in attendance then become a part of this contract the couple is making with God concerning their devotion, their marriage to each other. And this those people in attendance then having witnessed their public commitment to God. So this is our beginning point in a look at the foundation of marriage. Then the counseling moves along I'll quote some of what is in the book here. It says, marriage is a relationship between a man and a woman intended by God to be a monogamous relationship. Marriage is intended to be a permanent bond by which many human and relational needs are satisfied. The need to love and be loved, the need for deep friendship, the need for sharing and companionship, for sexual satisfaction, for children, the need to escape loneliness. Marriage ought to be a bond of love, reflecting the love Christ has for his people. A bond of sacrificial love, where a husband and wife have become one flesh, a union, unity. So let me ask you this question. What was the first observation that God made of Adam and his state? What was the last thing Adam did before God made Eve? Well, he named the animals, right? How did they come before him? God paraded them before Adam two by two. What did God say to Adam right before he brought all the animals before him to name? Genesis 2:18. You know, God was going to teach Adam something through his creation. He often uses his creative power, the things that exist that he's created, to teach us proper lessons. Genesis 2:18 is very familiar with this, and the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him. So God's providing a teaching moment for Adam. Then God causes Adam to sleep. We know that. He creates Eve from Adam by using one of Adam's ribs. And when Adam awakes, we're not given much narrative, are we? Boy, we would love to be a fly on the wall during those moments. I'm sure that those were moments where God the Father even got some smiles during those times. But we know that Adam calls Eve woman because she was taken from man. But then before Genesis 2 is finished, we're given a second piece of foundational information here. Who is told to leave? Who is told to leave? And Genesis 2:24 says, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So who is God instructing here? Well, at that time when, you know, from that time forward, society was more tribal. A young man didn't leave the family. It was quite the contrary. It was not only expected, but for the survival of the family and the sustaining of generational inheritance, having sons to pass along the land and with it to all the responsibilities that family leadership and providing for the extended family was passed on normally to the oldest son. That heavy responsibility was placed on his shoulders. And, you know, that son stayed and learned as much as he could from his father so that when his time came to lead, he could do it seamlessly. It was not uncommon for dad and mom, when they got to the age where they could no longer handle the physical rigors and demands of providing for the family and extended family, they'd moved into a smaller home, maybe at the back of the property, and the eldest son and his family would then take the reins, moving into the main home. So when God, through Moses, in verse 24, says, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, it's not so much addressing a geography or a distance, but the leave and cleave part is addressing a frame of mind. It's speaking to becoming one flesh, becoming one unit. one family unit. You know, when Tina and I were dating to be married, we had met each other at the feast in Reading in 1988. And in 89, she left Northern California to move up to Portland, and she was all of age 19. She took a bit of a risk on a young man who, believe me, was not fully prepared to be a husband or a father, for that matter. She traded everything she knew, all her friends, physical security, all her comfort, to move up to Portland and take a chance on me, take a chance on us. I didn't properly value that decision and how hard that decision was at the time. Over the years, I've become more appreciative of what it took for her to make that decision. Many people I called friends privately told her that, oh, you're going to have trouble. He's a mama's boy. And I guess that was partly true. I was 24 years old at the time. I was still living at home, renting a room. But I'll be honest, Mom did everything for me. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed it to the nth degree. And so there were some red flags that went up with my friends telling her, yeah, this might be tough. And certainly, like I said, the red flags did exist. After we were married, we moved into our first apartment. I think I adapted pretty well to my new role. I loved being married to Tina, still do. Much of what she was warned about, I think, didn't materialize. That's good. I guess the ultimate authority on that would be her. It did materialize in one specific way, and I think I've shared this a little bit with you before. It became a real source of contention early on for us. Mom's whole world was about how things were going for me. I was the baby. I was her last. I think I told you before, I have a brother and sister. But I was the one that was born after they were called into the church. So there are all these elements that converged, and Mom was hanging on with both hands to her little boy. And so Friday evenings, Tina would get phone calls from Mom saying, what are you fixing him for Sabbath dinner? Those kinds of things. You can imagine the conversations and how they went or didn't go. And then you can imagine the conversations that happened after the phone was hung up. I didn't leave and cleave properly. It took me a long time to draw a line for my mom in this regard. Something now I would handle much differently, of course. The instruction from God is to the husband to leave dad and mom and cleave to your wife and become one with her. Form your own household, your own family, and all that entails. That means listening to your wife and making sure she is comfortable and at home in your relationship and in the place where you're dwelling. You know, the greatest violation of the leave and cleave instruction by God is when the couple comes to an impasse in some area and they reach out to their parents to seek reinforcement for their position. The I'm right and you're wrong, and I'm going to bring in support to prove it, to prove I'm right. Again, leave and cleave is not as much of a geographical move, but an emotional and a functional relocation of allegiances, responsibilities, and obligations on a personal and intimate level. Sometimes putting some distance between dad and mom can aid the bonding process. It did for us about 4 years. I think we were married, what, a year and a half or so, 2 years? 2 years, a little over 2 years. And I got a job opportunity in Eugene. And so that moved us about 2.5 hours away. It was just enough distance for our daily lives to require her to lean on me and me to lean on her. And it really, for 4 years, really caused some growth in our marriage. So sometimes distance can help out a little bit in that regard. But it doesn't need to be that way if things are handled properly. Now, I realize today I'm speaking to more grandparent age crowd than I am young couples, and the responsibility to adhere to this principle as taught by God applies to us as well, and how we deal with our kids, making sure that we're not holding on too tightly and that they get out and they be able to establish their own families and relationships. Those are easy to say, but very hard to do, as we know. The challenge for us as parents who have invested an endless supply of everything we have and are into this young lady or this young man, it's just hard to turn that off. And, you know, in many cases, we don't turn it off, but we have to govern it. We have to provide some self-control. Logistically, functionally, in an agrarian society that Moses, the author that we read in Genesis, was addressing there, this was most likely even a more difficult challenge back then, as families stayed together and worked together. It must have been quite a challenge. But the instruction stands on its own, and the value, this new contract, this new covenant with God, must be recognized by all and treated with a proper respect. So two people need to walk through the challenges of life together. They need to rely on that contract that they made with their God. They need to rely on that relationship that they have built with God, and to navigate together the twists and turns that life is going to bring. You know, one of the most important concepts any couple needs to understand, of course, is love and the role it plays in marriage. This is a huge topic, and it deserves a lifetime of attention and pursuit. And, we won't spend a lot of time on the love topic here. When you talk about love to a young couple counseling for marriage, it can carry with it a host of different meanings. And it's much different than if you talk to an older couple about love. I remember, I think I shared with you, I remember my father coming over to my house less than a year after my mom died, and he was lonely. And he had told me many times, I don't do well alone. And so I kept thinking, well, maybe that's a plea to, move in, and I offered that, oh, no, I don't want that. And then he comes over, I think about 8 months after mom had passed, and said, I think I'm getting married. That was a shock. I just about fell over. The conversation I had with my dad about love and that connection was much different than you would have with younger 20-year-olds, because he had had a lifetime of loving and caring and being in that position. So certainly when you're counseling a younger couple, this conversation about love will be quite different. A couple's understanding of love and how it's woven into the fabric of a relationship is understandably different. The older, more experienced have a much different view, much more maybe full view of that. And as a counselor to couples pursuing marriage, the main thing we focus on is the understanding that love is something you do. It's a decision you make, supported by actions that you take. Love is a verb. It's not a noun. It's an action, not a place to be. When we look at those who have been married 50, 60, or more years, the love they have practiced over time reveals a long, comprehensive list of decisions made that have really weaved them together into one individual, into one unit, a tightly bound relationship where there's peace, there's a sense of calmness about being together. Their relationship is home. That's their home. Not the building or the structure they live in, but their marriage is home. I remember a song sung by Clint Black. He's in a Western music icon. The song was written by him and Donald Ewing. It was called Something That We Do. I don't know if you have heard that before. I'd play it for you, but the copywriters wouldn't like that very much. But I think I can read the lyrics to you without too much trouble. You could look it up and listen to it on your own. It's called Something That We Do. It says, I remember well the day we wed. I can see that picture in my head. I still believe the words we said forever will ring true. Love is certain, love is kind. Love is yours, and love is mine. But it isn't something that we find, it's something that we do. It's holding tight, letting go. It's flying high and laying low. Let your strongest feelings show, and your weakness too. It's a little and a lot to ask, and endless and a welcome task. Love isn't something that we have, it's something that we do. We help to make each other all that we can be, though we can find our strength and inspiration independently. The way we work together is what sets our love apart, so closely that we can't tell where I end and where you start. It gives me heart remembering how we started with a simple vow. There's so much to look back on now. Still, it feels brand new. We're on the road that has no end, and each day we begin again. Love's not just something that we're in, it's something that we do. We help to make each other all that we can be, though we can find our strength and inspiration independently. The way we work together is what sets our love apart, so closely that we can't tell where I end and where you start. Love is wide, love is long. Love is deep, and love is strong. Love is why I love this song, and I hope you love it too. I remember well the day we wed. I can see that picture in my head. Love isn't just those words we said. It's something that we do. There's no request too big or small. We give ourselves, we give our all. Love isn't some place that we fall. It's something that we do. Many of you probably hear the tune in your head as I'm reading those words. It's a simple song, but packed with meaning concerning the point that love is a decision we make, and that decisions lead to positive, supportive action on our part. We who are called out of the world by God, whose very nature is self-described as love, should understand this more completely than the rest of the world. So one of the things we ask couples to do is we ask them to list three of the most important scriptures upon which you would like to base your marriage on. So three of the most important scriptures upon which you would like to base your marriage. And we typically tell them they have to be more creative than going to Ephesians 5, let's say. That's Paul's collections, a collection of relational instructions. Paul's instructions here are we're very familiar with. I won't read them all because, like I said, we're aware of them. But for me as a husband, Paul creates a pretty high standard for my role. Ephesians 5 and verse 25, he writes, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body and his flesh and of his bones." You know, Paul's words go back to Genesis 2, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, right? He's calling to mind that verse. We've been made from Christ, and he cares for us with the same care he would give himself. Remember, God has given all things to Christ, and therefore Christ considers all things ours in him. As husbands, measuring ourselves against Christ in our love toward our wives, that's a tall order for sure. We read those words, and if you contemplate the words that Paul wrote in Ephesians to us as husbands, you take a big gulp. It's a tall order. Laying down our lives takes on much more meaning than just being willing to die for our wives or families, but being willing to live for them each and every day, to be a part of everything they need, not just to survive, but to thrive physically and spiritually as well. If you read through Ephesians, you get that flavor that Christ supplied the spiritual knowledge that his body needs to grow. And so therefore, as husbands, we need to make sure that the families are not just physically being fed and taken care of, but that the families also have a steady diet of spiritual food from God as well. There's a spiritual accountability to the job God gave husbands, just as Christ is fulfilling that to the church. 1 Peter 3 is another spot that a lot of people would go. And in the book here, they don't really allow you to go there to find your foundational scripture. They want you to dig deeper, right? But in 1 Peter 3, Peter, equally excellent collection of marital instruction concerning the roles that God expects us to fill. His instruction in verse 1 through 6, where Peter talks to women about concentrating on adorning themselves inwardly, accepting of their calling as wives, and working on beautifying their heart and their gentle spirit. Not worrying about the outward part, but more about the inward part, right? Using the gifts of that they've been given to discipline their conduct and to add their important part to the marriage. And then in verse 7, husbands are reminded they are heirs together and that there is a godly expectation that we learn to understand and honor the role with a kicker, that our prayers could be hindered if we do not learn to understand and honor the role that our wives play in our marriages. I found over the years my prayers have been much more effective when my prayers are outward and not inward. I don't know about you, I receive a lot more answer to prayer when I'm praying for people, other people, and when I'm praying for my family than I am praying for myself. The other common place for couples to go is 1 Corinthians 13, of course, a love chapter. It's a good place to study and compare oneself to what attributes God says love represents. So if we make all these verses off limits to who we're counseling, they still have to put down their three most important scriptures to build a marriage on. Some might point to the relationship that really has nothing to do with marriage, at least directly, but speaks to a beautiful, loving commitment. Remember in the book of Ruth, how Ruth promised and made that commitment to her mother-in-law. And I'll just read Ruth 1, verses 16 and 17. Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you, for wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." So there might be some that I would counsel that would pull out that particular inference and occasion to say, that's the kind of mentality I want to build my marriage around. You know, in essence, this was the message Tina was giving me when she moved up at age 19. This was a statement our daughter-in-law, Caitlin, was making to our son, Brandon, when she threw everything she had in her car days after Brandon left ABC to come home. She threw everything in her car, and if it wasn't for the fact that Brandon was flying, she might have beat him to the doorstep. In essence, that's what she was saying to Brandon then. So we say, list for us three scripture verses you would like to base your marriage on. To help their minds begin to work in the right areas, we might read Matthew 7, verses 24 through 27. We're familiar again with that. Those passages, Christ said, "Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on a rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on the house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock." So this book is a book of lists. It guides couples to gather a wide swath of information so that they can think about those and talk about them as a couple. And it's all with the purpose of making sure that two people can agree upon the basic godly principles upon which a godly marriage is to be built upon. So next, we would ask the couple, list what you believe are 10 firm foundations or ingredients on which will go into making a solid marriage relationship. Now, if the couple, again, is in their early 20s, this may be a little bit of a challenge. The older and more experienced will be able to fill out this list fairly quickly and easily. So we're looking for quality on this list. We're not looking for quantity. It wouldn't be surprising a young couple only came up with 4 or 5 or 6, maybe. But again, quality is what we're looking for, not quantity in this list. If you're single, this still can apply to you. As you think in terms of your covenant with God and the foundational stones in place that you deem are immovable to that relationship. If you're married, this is a great exercise to go through in terms of what those 10 foundational stones that the structure of your marriage has been built on. And are they solid enough to help you weather the storms of life? In the spirit of, you know, what I said at the beginning, your periodic automobile maintenance plan to keep your car on the road and working, well, maybe crawling underneath the house and checking the foundation to see if there are any needs. Sometimes the ground sinks a little bit. Maybe one of the foundation pillars is not able to do its job. Maybe outside forces, maybe water damage, maybe bugs, those kinds of things. I know I'm building a physical picture here, but you get the inference that it's not a bad thing to crawl under the house and take a look every once in a while and make sure that the foundation that you believe is there and functioning correctly and is working the way it should. How long has it been since you have examined the foundation of your marriage, circled around on those things together, and talked about them? I'll share three examples. Hopefully you can come up with more. One of the most important yet challenging principles is put each other first in life. Put each other first in life. Now, I say this is challenging because the landscape of life is constantly moving and shifting, isn't it? And it's moving for each of you independently as well. You have your own jobs and responsibilities, and the landscape of your life can change on a dime. It can happen very quickly. You view things differently by nature of how God put you together. You likely come from different family backgrounds. All of these factors and more make this a moving target. And, I'll speak to men because I are one. One of the main problems, I think, that plague men in failed relationships, when you look at relationships that fail, one of the main problems that I see time and time again from the men's side of things is that women are just an addition to his collection of toys. He has a truck, he has a motorcycle, he has a boat, and she's just one more of those possessions or obligations. For men, we can easily slip into this mode without ever realizing it happened. It can be painful and an uncomfortable realization. Hopefully we're married to women that will give us that sharp elbow in the ribs to make us sit up straight and pay attention if they feel like they're being treated more as a possession than a partner, than an equal. But it can happen, and hopefully our wives have very sharp elbows when it comes to these kinds of things. It's far too easy for us as men to begin treating our wives as something less than an equal partner. Remember, heirs together, 1 Peter 3:7, remember? It says, dwell with them in, with understanding, giving honor to the wife as the weaker vessel, so the physically weaker, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. Finding that things in life aren't going the way you'd like them to go, maybe this is an area that needs some attention. Maybe your prayers are bouncing off the ceiling. There've been times in my life where I think I've treaded in this area. Not purposely, but maybe gotten pulled a little bit. And a sharp elbow from a caring wife got me back on track. So being able to look at your spouse in the eye and say with absolute certainty that there is no one on the planet more important than you are, and to have a response to that be, I know that. That's a huge foundational piece for your marriage. A second foundational piece, communication. Communication. Now, this is a challenging one as well, no matter what the age or length of your marriage. There's a difference between talking and communicating, right? Tina and I do a lot of talking. But to communicate, you actually have to be engaged with what the other person is saying. Now, Tina has a little bit of an out here. Her hearing, especially with my low monotone voice, I'll say something and I can see the look. I understand the look. The look is, I'm pretty sure I heard what you said, but I'm computing, trying to figure it out. And so I have to repeat it, maybe at a different decibel or a different inflection in my voice. She has an out. Her ears don't pick up my tone as well. But how many times have any of you been sitting at home and both in the same room, maybe doing a few different things, and one of you reading something out loud, and when you're done reading, you stop because you've asked a question or you're expecting a response and you get no response. Why is that? Because there was talking going on, but there was not communication going on. Tina and I have both of these facial expressions that we get, and hers is more or less, I didn't hear you. Mine is more or less, oh boy, I'm going to be in trouble because she said something to me I'm supposed to respond to, and I don't know what, I wasn't listening. So it's the tape playing back, hoping to catch and bail myself out from being in trouble, right? Because I'm not listening, I'm not communicating. There's just talking going on. So how often does this happen in your marriage? If I was a betting man, I would say that most of you wouldn't be able to account for all the times that has happened in your life, in your marriage. It happens probably quite a lot. So keep working on communication, not just talking. You know, in counseling, we talk about things like time. The third thing that I'll offer as an example is time. Time spent together. You know, one of the items that Mrs. Luker is constantly reminding me about is making time, taking the time for Tina and I to be together and to do things together. That time is a currency I need to spend on my wife. And I know Leanne's probably saying in her head, well, have you? I know, I just know. And all I can say is we're working on that. It's been a challenge. Like I said, the life is a lot of moving parts, and things can change on a dime for both of us. And so what is our level of commitment to each other when things change? The point is, you can't live separate lives and have the kind of close, intimate, and enjoyable marriage you both desire. Time is a currency best spent on the things that are important to you in life. Where and how are you spending your time? The book then covers reasons for marriage. I'll read part of that. Reasons for marriage. There are a few positive reasons for marriage that are included here. Now, this is just chapter one. It's the beginning of the book. It says, a few positive reasons for marriage. Companionship. To work together and fulfill your own and your future mate's needs. To fulfill sexual needs in the way God intends. Love, an adequate blending of the various types of love is explained in chapter 3. So we're talking about eros, philia, agape. And fifth, because you are convinced that it is God's will for you to marry this person. That actually doesn't happen as often as you think, but it happened to me. It was very obvious to me. God made it very obvious. Hopefully some of these positive reasons for marriage exist in your marriage. These are just a few. These are just five. There's probably a long list. Again, if I had you write down on a piece of paper and hand up to the front a list of positive reasons for marriage, there would probably be hundreds of different reasons that come from reliable sources that have lived and been married for quite some time. It also covers things that are not a basis of marriage. Not a basis for marriage is to spite or get back at your parents because of negative self-image. Marrying your fiancé will make you feel worthwhile and give meaning to your life. Another reason would be to be a therapist or counselor to your fiancé. Fear of being left out, being single forever. Fear of independence. Marrying on the rebound. You were hurt in a former love relationship, and to ease your hurt, you immediately choose another. Not a basis for marriage would be fear of hurting the other person. You're afraid of what will happen if your fiance to your fiance if you break up. Another one is to escape an unhappy home because you're pregnant or your fiance is pregnant, because you have had sex. There's a number of reasons here that are reasons that are not a basis for starting a marriage. Now, remember, this is premarital counseling. Some of us marrieds, obviously some of these things that I may have read may have been part of our backgrounds. And bully to you, who many of you have fought through some of mistakes or issues and problems and have built wonderful marriages in spite of maybe starting out a little rough. This is for premarital counseling. But we would agree that it's not a good start to include some of these things as reasons or a base for marriage. Another exercise that the book asks the couple to go through is evaluate your marriageability by examining the personal traits of yourself and your fiancé. So list 8 character traits or personality traits that you feel will help your marriage. So you do this for yourself, and then you do this for your fiancé. And once that's done, we turn to Galatians 5, verses 22 and 23. And we look at the fruit of the Spirit. And the book says, would these traits, when they are manifested in a person, increase the potential for success in a marriage? Well, that's kind of an easy answer, isn't it? Then the exercise moves to seeing if the traits that were listed in this list that you made match any of the fruit of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, virtue, faith, meekness, humility, self-control. At the end of just the first chapter of this book, it offers up 8 more traits that give a person a greater possibility of having an enriched and satisfying marriage. Let's see if I can... 8 more traits that will add to an enriched marriage. Adaptability and flexibility, the ability to change and adapt. In fact, I'm pretty positive because I've heard him say it 2 or 3 times in messages. Robin Weber coined the phrase, and maybe he took it from someone, I don't know, but I know it from his mouth, blessed are the flexible, for they will not be bent out of shape. And that's such a true statement. We have to be flexible. If life offers one thing in spades, as we've said before, it would be that it's always changing, and the landscape is always changing, and our ability to adapt and to meet the challenges together will go a long way to bring this positive element to our marriage. Second attribute would be empathy, the ability to be sensitive to the needs, hurts, and desires of others, to feel with them and experience the world from their perspective. You know, sympathy and empathy are two different things. We know that. The ability to really feel deep inside the needs and the hurts and desires of others comes really from life experience, doesn't it? The beauty of a healthy marital relationship is that you get to compound your experience. You get to double it at least, if not more, because you're adding not only another person in your experience in life, but you're adding their families and their friends. And so you get to the point of understanding empathy that much faster as your circle grows in that regard. And you have someone to share those feelings and experiences with and to be able to communicate together with. Third, the ability to work through problems. You know, when a couple's harnessed correctly, and when I use the word harnessed, where does your mind go automatically? 2 Corinthians 6, verses 14 and 15 says, concerning two people who are spiritually pulling their own weight, but doing it together toward a shared or a common goal. They're equally yoked together in a harness. The results are exponential. They don't just pull what they could pull times two, but two together pull much more than that. It's a beautiful thing to see in marriages and in families and in congregations. There's no such thing as a marriage without problems. There's no such thing as a family or a congregation without problems. The ability to work through them is a godly trait, and it is such a benefit for us to have the Spirit of God on board and then be able to work together in a marriage to pull against all the things that are happening in life and to get accomplished what we need to get accomplished. Fourth attribute is the ability to give and receive love. You know, we're all different in how we express our love. Some of us are very public. We have couples that we know that after every prayer they kiss, right? We have couples we know that hold hands all the time, just 24/7. Seems like they always have they're always holding each other's hand. Couples are different, and each of us deal with our, you know, how we give and receive love differently. None of that really matters. What matters is if it works for you, and if you are being able to express and share your love together as a couple the way you are comfortable sharing it. Emotional stability, accepting and controlling one's emotion. That's another awesome attribute. It takes a lot of work, I know. Number six, communication skills. We talked about communication, being able to really communicate, not just talk, but to really communicate. And seven, similarities between the two people. There's a statement, it's not in this book, that I got somewhere else. It says, couples marry for their similarities and they stay together for their differences. And if you think about that and what that means, it holds a lot of truth. The beauty is that there are things about ourselves that we discover as life goes on. We can look in the mirror and say, you know, there are some things I really don't like about myself. I'm really not good at these things. And the longer we are in our marriages, the more we appreciate the fact that our spouse isn't like us in those areas. And if, you know, if we're matched really well, there will be areas that we really are terrible at that our wives or our husbands are really good at. And we learn as we pull together, right? We learn that one can pull a little harder in those areas than we can and make us better people. It's interesting, too. Number 8 says similar family backgrounds. That's certainly a benefit when you're going into a marriage. If you have some similar upbringings, I would say probably most of us maybe didn't have similar upbringings. But, you know, the real benefit that we see in the church today is that many of our young people, they have similar backgrounds because they're second, third, fourth generation Christians. They've been in the church, their families are in the church, and they've been there a long time. And so there's a lot less for them to overcome when it comes to family background. What a blessing that is to our kids, having that opportunity. And so, having similar family backgrounds and experiences can be a powerful tool to helping our marriages to get off on the right foot. For those of us that obviously didn't have that in common when we were married, it certainly added some wrinkles to our early married life, and probably still does at times. Like I said, what a blessing if that doesn't exist, if there's just a lot of similarities. So for those of us who have been married for a while, we no doubt recognize that the growth in these areas over the years, as I've talked through this, your mind has gone there. God has a way of allowing life to bring us improvement and education for our good. The goal for all of us is, of course, being better at these things each year. But we also know things come out of left field and things that we're never truly prepared for. Loss of parents, loss of a mate, loss of child. Loss of close friends, major mistakes and sins that we might make, errors in judgment, huge financial blunders. No matter the cause or outcome, a deep and meaningful marriage that has spent years in doing in love can draw on its strength to battle during these times. The beauty of a strong and godly marriage is that the character that each person has earned lives on, even through death, to benefit others as well. The character that we take into the grave with us, God doesn't allow that to go away. And it will benefit others long after we've met our death and been resurrected. That character lives on, and it lives on in those that they've left behind. You know, I to the memorial, and I said the memorial was awesome. It was be able to see the effect that both Paul and Maureen Bird had on many people. They are both gone, and that's sorrowful, especially to those that were very close to them and family. But the character that they built and instilled, and the marriage that they had together had an impact that will ripple way, way on into the future, the people that they know. Many of you have that same opportunity. You know, this is really the first chapter of the journey of counseling someone, premarital counseling. There's 13 more chapters to go, and we'll cover many, many other things when I'm counseling someone for marriage. My focus today was to share with you some engaging material in hopes of maybe sparking an oil change, a checkup, a tune-up, if you will, for those that have been married a while. Go back and revisit some things. Make sure that foundation of your marriage is founded on the things that are right and that you both agree on. And for those that are not married, with your spiritual thinking hat on, I've offered some analogies that are applicable in both in your relationship with God and your brothers and sisters here in the congregation as well. So, like I said, in the flavor of a tune-up, I hope you take the opportunity to tune up your marriages.